From their mountain stronghold somewhere in Colorado, Lyconians Talk Radio proudly presents The Image Doctors.
Hey, it's May 11th, 2006, and we are the Image Doctors. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And we want to thank our member Shannon Atkinson from New Orleans, Louisiana in the USA for providing us with that nice intro music. Thanks, Shannon. We appreciate it.
Yep, sure do.
If anybody else out there wants to have their music used on the Image Doctors, send us a brief MP3 clip to talkradio@nikonians.org, and we'll decide if it's worthy or not. They're all worthy. Today, our podcast is brought to you by one of Nikonian's sponsors, Roberts Camera, www.robertsimaging.com. Great camera shop, great service. They're a Nikonian sponsor. You may have seen their banners on the webpage, in the forums, and elsewhere. Definitely give them a call if you're looking to get something, a Nikon product. They're an authorized Nikon dealer. I have purchased from them in the past myself, and I have to say that the service and the price is excellent.
Me too. Yep.
So that's Robert's Camera. What else is going on?
Well, I think we're going to do some announcements, but in terms of the topics that we'll get to later on today, we'll talk a little bit about the review that we promised of the 200-400 VR lens that we're very happy with.
Yep.
But we'll talk a little bit about why we ended up getting those, some of the attributes of the lens, how it works in the field, all those things.
As if your NAS wasn't in full force already.
Oh, yeah.
If you have problems with your budget, don't listen to this episode, folks.
Hit the stop button right now. The second thing that we're going to talk a little bit about is we had a request from a listener to discuss the autofocus modes that are found on the D2X, D2HS in particular, but they also apply pretty well for the D200.
Yeah, and this particular request, I should point out, came from the Nikonians podcast feedback forum, which is in the Amongst Nikonians section of our forums. We do have a dedicated forum for talking about podcasts. If you want to, you know, get immediate feedback, or if you don't want to email us, please go there and check it out.
We're feeling lonely at this point.
It's pretty quiet over there, but you know, all the feedback so far has been great, and we do listen and we do check it out.
Yep.
So do that. Last time we mentioned that there would be new t-shirts available, and I'm happy to say that those are now available in our shop, both in Europe and in the U.S. Of course, we do ship worldwide. The price on you might be a Nikonian if they're heavyweight black cotton, high-quality silkscreen print, orange letters. There's a picture there on the website of these in the shop.
We both have one.
Yeah, I've got one. Rick's got one. I will say that they were the envy of everyone who worked at Nikon. We were the envy of all of the Nikon professional reps and the people at their trade show booth at PMA. They all wanted one. So this is a hot item. They're incredibly well-priced. I think it's $14.95 in the U.S. and about 12.5 euro in Europe, and that's including VAT. Good deal. And we ship worldwide, so check those out.
They're fun.
Yep. And another new product in the Pro Shop is the Teeny Markins Q3 Emil ball head. And I think it's about $250 US, give or take.
Right around there.
Something like that. A new smaller, even smaller than the M10, with, again, the same 80-to-1 load ratio. This thing weighs about a pound, or a little, even less than a pound, I think. And it can hold, I think, something like 65 pounds.
Be really nice if you're using one of those really compact, lightweight tripods.
Right. I mean, if you're not putting a big rig on this thing. But, I mean, this thing is strong enough to hold a D2X kind of setup, and very small. Maybe a good travel ball head if you're into doing stuff like that. And then the last little bit is, if you haven't heard already, there's a new podcast that's coming out every week called Nikonians News Flash, hosted by Jessica Odell, who just happens to be my sister. And she will bring you up to date briefly, about 5 or 6 minutes each time, up to date on what's going on in the community. new happening threads and forums, new stuff in the shop, all kinds of things. So that way we don't have to always talk about that, and we can right. talk about photography. So download those from the podcast page, podcasts.nikonians.org, mm-hmm. and you'll be all set.
Okay. How about we start talking about the 200 to 400 review?
Let's do that, because yeah. it's really, really cool.
I guess starting off, let's discuss why we ended up picking those. And I think in your case, it was just because you wanted to copy me.
That's right.
But
and in your case, it was because you wanted to copy Brian Scherzer.
I did, after having used the lens. Yeah. yeah.
Brian, we hate you because you know.
But not really.
Actually, we love you. Our wives probably hate you.
Yeah, that would be more accurate.
Well, I mean, I had an I have a Sigma 500 millimeter mm-hmm. autofocus lens, and I bought that great lens, and I bought that lens when I was shooting film.
And it's a pretty fast lens, 4.5.
Yeah, fast autofocus. I could use it with certain limitations with a teleconverter. And when I moved to digital, it was working effectively as a 740 millimeter lens, I think, with the crop factor, about 700. 750, that's right. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I'm too early in the morning for me to.
I had that extra math in college.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That's what you get for being a biology major and you're an engineer.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, that was, I found myself, you know, wanting more focal length when I was doing things like small birds, but running into problems where if there was a large mammal, I had a huge gap in focal length between my next smallest lens, which is the 70 to 200 VR. Right.
Yeah, in my case, I also had a 500 millimeter lens. Mine was a little bit older one. It was the Nikon P lens. You know, it's an f/4 manual focus lens, although it works fine with the newer autofocus cameras. It's
shipped.
Got all the electrical contacts and stuff. The problem I was running into, partially it was the same thing, in that sometimes the focal length was great and just the right thing, but if an animal was moving around a little bit, it was a little bit awkward. You know, but 500 millimeter lenses aren't small.
No.
And it takes more than just a few seconds to switch them out for a shorter lens. And it was just a little bit awkward at times. But the main thing for me was the fact that it didn't have autofocus. I still got a lot of nice shots with it and got several years of use out of it. I bought it used at a really great price, so I actually ended up making a little bit of money when I sold it. But the problem was I was also missing a lot of shots, and it was a bit frustrating just because I could not focus enough in some situations. And even though I'm pretty decent at it, it just
and once you get to the
struggle at times.
I mean, part of my reason for buying the Sigma 500 was, well, price. But another reason why I liked that lens was because it was a little bit smaller form factor. It was a little easier to handle than the 500 millimeter f/4 Nikon, which is a bigger lens.
Yeah.
And as soon as you get up into that kind of territory, this is the thing that's going to take up half your camera bag. You know, these lenses weigh 7 or 8 pounds or more. You know, now you need a tripod. You have to invest in other things. Well, the 200 to 400 VR is about the same size and weight as my Sigma 500 4.5 was, because it's a slightly shorter focal length. And I hemmed and hawed for a long time about whether or not this would be something I'd want in my bag. Because on the one hand, you have, well, it's 100 millimeters shorter.
Right.
On the other hand, you have potential positives. It's a zoom lens, so it's more versatile. It focuses incredibly close, down to 6 feet or just under 3 meters, which is something that the 500 millimeter lenses will not do. The Sigma focuses at about 13 feet, and the Nikon focuses at about 15 or 16 feet. So when a particularly small animal, if you are in a situation like we were in Texas where you're in a blind and that animal may come in very close, having a 6-foot minimum focusing distance is incredibly useful.
Absolutely.
And I think you get a magnification ratio of like 1 to 3 with this lens. So that's really quite nice. The no-brainer is, well, VR is a feature of this lens. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then just in general, autofocus performance, you know. So in terms of the versatility, I thought about it, and I said, well, let's see. I was in film, and 500 millimeters with film, I could extend that to 700 millimeter focal length with a TC14. Now I'm on digital. This 200 to 400 is effectively the same angle of view as using a 300 to 600 f4. And if I add a teleconverter, I'm getting effectively up to an 840 millimeter angle of view.
Pretty good.
Pretty good. I thought to myself, I said, well, geez, you know, if I was happy with 700 millimeters in film, why wouldn't I be happy with 840 millimeters with digital? And quite frankly, one of the challenging things that I had was that when you start getting to these obscene focal lengths, if you're not on a tripod locked down using mirror lockup, you're going to start to see the effect of camera shake in your images just because, you know, there's a lot of vibrations in there, especially when your target is, you know, 100 feet away or something like that, or 30 meters away. And you can start to see these in your images. And so at some point, it becomes a diminishing returns.
Yeah. And in my case, I was actually thinking about buying your old Sigma because you were thinking about upgrading to the new Sigma 500.
Right, which is the same lens but has better coatings. Yeah.
In the end, we both ended up not doing that.
No offense to Sigma because, like I said, I stand behind that lens. The Sigma 500 f4.5 is an excellent lens.
Well, I had a chance to use it too, you know, and trying it out, and it was excellent. Yeah. I had no complaints optically.
It's a very good lens. Yeah. But there are some things about moving into professional Nikkor glass that suddenly make you realize why Nikon lenses have such a wonderful reputation.
Yeah, and I think I got mine, what, about a month before you got yours?
Yeah,
and I had a chance
PMA,
to. Yeah, I had a chance to start, you know, shooting some photos with it, and you know, I did some typical shots down the street, and there were some mailboxes and things like that. I have lots of nice little letters on it, so I could start seeing how it looked, and I tried some shots, you know, wide open, stopped down a little bit, with and without teleconverters, tried the TC14E, also tried the TC20E. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, those first shots that I got back were just utterly amazing. It was like, oh, wow, I'm going to like this a lot. The image quality is unbelievable, really.
It's got to be one of those top performers. And
yeah.
Well, before we get into that, because there's some points I want to make about the image quality, and because I do have a comparison to my 500.
Right.
You know, things that you're giving up versus, you know, what give and take. Basic specs on this lens is that it's constant aperture f4, 24 elements in 17 groups.
A lot
of elements, yeah. It's internal focusing, internal zoom. The lens, you know, obviously isn't going to change length. It's got weather sealing. Gasket. The front element, which is the protective element, is not flat. It's curved. It's meniscus shaped, and it's removable. They say if you are in such a situation where lens flare is really getting you down,
and it conceivably could with that number of elements. I haven't seen it to be a problem yet, but
yeah, I mean,
it's nice having the option.
In general, though, that, you know, it's niceable.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I mean, in theory, should you, God forbid, ding your front element, it would be replaceable, I'm sure, for a pretty penny.
Yep.
Let's see. Looking at this, it's a G lens, so there's no aperture ring. So if you're looking for, you know, if you're using an older body, you're not going to be able to set the aperture on this lens. So that would be a problem. The aperture scale goes to f32, so from 4 to 32.
Somehow I doubt that'll ever get used
right.
by me.
I've never used it beyond much more than f8.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about that because performance at f4 being a thing. It does have a focus limiter switch on it to limit you between the full focus range or between 6 meters and infinity. Mm-hmm. There's no close limit setting. Built-in tripod collar, the foot rotates. And then the size is... approximately, yeah, it's pretty big. It's about the same size as the Sigma 500, so it's a little smaller than the Nikon 500, a little shorter. 365 millimeter extension from the camera's lens mounting flange with the lens protective glass attached. And then there's the carbon fiber hood that goes on top of that.
Yeah.
And the diameter is 124 millimeters at the widest.
Yep.
And it weighs 3,275 grams. For you in the U.S. That's 7.2 pounds.
It's big.
It's big. But let's just talk about the performance and the versatility and things like that. And so what you were saying with you're being blown away by the images, and why was that? Why were you blown away by those?
Because they were very sharp.
It
wasn't really just that, although they were. The images quality
excellent.
Was just as good as I've ever seen. The contrast level was
There's really
high.
No light fall off.
No. And the other thing is the out of focus areas of the image, that's more important, in my opinion, if you're using the lens for wildlife.
Right, where you're isolating a subject.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh. It's just pretty.
Yeah.
It's just smooth.
This is a Bokeh Champion lens.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not that picky on that stuff, but boy, is it nice.
It makes a difference when you see
it.
You know, you might not think about it until you do use this lens. And like we were saying, don't use this lens don't try one if you don't want to be amazed. Think about the sharpness too. While the sharpness does improve as you stop the lens down a little bit, it's almost unnoticeable.
Yeah.
I mean, wide open at F4.
Even with the TC14E teleconverter.
And I was very much in the mindset of if I put the TC14 on any of my lenses, whether it was the Sigma 500 or my 70-200, I needed to maybe stop down a stop to get optimal performance. This is not true with the 200-400 zoom. It is amazing, even with the TC14E wide open.
Yeah.
Now, with the other teleconverters, I don't have any. You have a TC20E, right?
Yeah. So here's what I would say about that one is it's for emergency purposes, really. At least I wasn't that satisfied with the image quality. There's a noticeable drop off in sharpness.
So you're going to want to stop down.
I mean, it's very usable, you know, if you're not making a big print or if you're not going to be really picky about things. You know, so I definitely would take it along. I took it along to Texas. I used it a few times. You know, curiously, I didn't end up doing much with those images just for whatever reason. But, you know, it's okay for emergency purposes. Probably the 17E would be a little bit better, I think.
And I think with the 17E, from everything I've heard, some feedback we've been getting from listeners and some feedback I've gotten from talking to some folks at the Nikon booth at trade shows and stuff, is that the 14E with one of these big Nikon lenses, you can probably use it wide open and get professional quality results. The 17E, you might want to stop it down a little bit. The 20E, you're going to definitely need to stop it down a little bit to obtain acceptable results, and they might not be as sharp as what you get with the 14 or the 17.
You're also turning an F4 lens into an F8 lens with the 20E.
You're compromising performance with the autofocus.
Right.
Now, autofocus performance, as long as we're talking about converters and things, I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah.
This lens focuses incredibly fast.
Now, the one thing I would suggest is using that limiter switch that we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, if you're shooting subjects beyond 6 meters.
Mm-hmm. Which is not uncommon. When we were down in Texas photographing those birds, generally speaking, they were a little bit further than that, so I was able to use the limiter switch almost all the time. And the virtue with it is if you lose focus lock, which can happen on occasion for a variety of reasons, or if you're just, you know, acquiring a new subject, the lens doesn't go through its full range before reacquiring it. And since it does have such a close focusing distance, it's a wide range. Mm-hmm. So a lens that focuses really fast can sometimes take a little bit longer to reacquire because of that. So use the limiter if you can.
And be careful when take care when you use it, because I ran into this problem. All of a sudden, I'm following a little bird when we're in a blind, and all of a sudden, it wasn't focusing. I'm like, what the heck is going on?
You got to think about it.
And then I remembered, oh, wait, I had the limiter on.
Yeah.
So I turned that off so it could.
And this is a good tip for autofocus lenses in general, is think about using the limiter. I've got one of the 300 F4 AFS lenses. It also focuses very, very closely. And it's very fast focusing. But if it loses lock and it's on the full setting, it takes a little while.
Yeah. So the autofocus performance is excellent. The optical performance is second to none. As far as I'm concerned, this lens is in a class by itself in terms of its performance, especially wide open. I did some really unscientific comparisons at the 200 millimeter focal length between this lens and my 70-200. Now, some people would argue that the 70 to 200 isn't as sharp at 200 as it is maybe slightly up. But let's just compare apples to apples here. At a given aperture, the 200 to 400 was sharper than the 70 to 200. And that meant if I shot the 70 to 200 at f4, which was stopped down a stop, the 200 to 400 was still sharper at f4, which was wide open for that lens. To me, that was – I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it.
Because that's an awfully good lens.
I have no problem with the 70 to 200. I find it to be one of the sharpest, nicest lenses I have.
Now, let's talk a little bit about VR.
Yeah, because that's sort of the other big feature why this lens has been attractive to a lot of people. Yeah,
and sometimes you'll read comments about, well, you know, you're not going to handhold that lens. You're going to use it on a tripod, which is true, I think, in general. Why would you need VR? Well, I'll tell you, it's nice. And the reason it's nice is that this lens works great on a gimbal mount, you know, such as the regular Wimberly one or the Wimberly Sidekick,
or the
which is what we
Kirk
were both
King
using.
Cobra.
Yeah, any of those
gimbal heads, but
it works great because if you've got a subject that's moving around, what you don't really want to do is lock down your tripod and then try to take the shot. It's a lot nicer if you can leave the Wimberly mount loose and able to swivel around, and the VR feature will help you get sharp results even doing that.
And let's face it, sometimes just handling the camera, you're introducing jiggle when you're dealing with focal lengths that are this long, and there's a little bit of motion blur.
So I'm convinced, you know, VR is a great thing on longer focal lengths, and I'm sure that when it shows up on some of Nikon's longer lenses, it'll be very appreciated.
Absolutely.
It is useful.
Now, here's another thing why VR would be useful is that now you have quite possibly a wonderful monopod rig.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a versatile lens with VR where a monopod is not going to be as stable of a platform.
And we've both shot with it that way.
And I'm still learning how to use a monopod. But I wouldn't really, you know, a monopod usually necessitates fast shutter speeds. So you can get away with a little bit more, with a little slower shutter speeds if you have the VR lens. Remember, as we always mention, that VR does not compensate for subject motion. Okay, if that little bird flitters a teeny tiny bit, and you're shooting at slow shutter speed or a fairly slow shutter speed, it's not going to be enough to stop the action, but it will stop the camera shake. And the VR has two modes. The normal mode, which doesn't cancel out panning, and then active mode, which tries to cancel out all motion.
Yeah, and the stereotypical example of how the active mode gets used is if you're on a ship that's bobbing up and down in the water or something like that. Yeah, it helps. But the other way to think about it is just what you mentioned. If you're in a situation where you don't care about panning, active mode might do a slightly better job stabilizing the image.
Right.
But both seem to work really, really well.
Now, this lens has some other neat little features that you get with just seem to be nice touches. You know, you have to decide for yourself if it justifies the price. This lens is about $5,000 in the United States, give or take. I don't know what it sells for overseas. Could be more than that. But $5,000 is not cheap.
No.
This is an incredible investment. What do you get for that? What are the differences that I saw coming from a third-party lens, which, again, I like very much? What I found some nice things here is that in this lens, AFS works the way that it's intended to. If you grab the focus ring and you turn it, autofocus is completely disengaged by the camera, even if you're engaging autofocus with the shutter release button. It will stop trying to autofocus against you. It will allow manual focus to completely override, and it also switches you into focus, into release priority shutter mode. That's a good and a bad thing. It's very good for touching up focus when you want to recompose. Maybe that little bird or that chipmunk is not, you don't want it bullseye in the frame and you want to lock the focus. You can do that. The downside is you got to be very careful, because if you bump that focusing ring inadvertently, camera's going to take a picture, it's going to be out of focus, and you're not going to know what the heck is wrong, and you're going to think maybe your focusing your camera has a problem. And we'll talk about that in the next segment of our show, but that's something to keep in mind. Build quality is just absolutely wonderful. Mm-hmm. The weather sealing that we mentioned, it's got a rubber gasket and the O-ring seal on the F mount. It's got a neat function in this lens that's something that hasn't been seen in a while, which is the focus preset function. This is pretty cool. It's kind of gimmicky, but it's still pretty cool. And I can see it being used by people outside of, by photographers who are doing sports more than anything else. But I'll give you an example. There's a little button on the side of this lens that allows you to say, I'm going to preset this focus point, whatever you have in focus right now. So you focus on a tree branch or you focus on second base at the baseball game, and then you push this little preset lock and it says, okay, that's locked. Now you're going about doing your business. When you see the subject of interest, go back to that predetermined spot. Assuming you haven't changed your own position, you push the recall button, which are the AF lock or the multifunction buttons on the end of the barrel at the distal end of the lens, and bang, the lens just goes right back to that preset distance, and you don't have to hunt for focus. I tried this in Texas because we had certain blinds where there were multiple branches, multiple perch points, and so I would lock on and say, okay, if the bird comes here to, say, this close branch, while I'm looking at the ones out far, I'm going to be able to really jump on that quickly by pushing that button. I found that in theory it's great. In practice, it takes a little bit more effort.
Yeah.
And this is my nit to pick with the lens, is that those focus recall buttons, those AF buttons, are the little rubber buttons on the end of the lens. They're almost too far away to use.
They're way the heck out there. I think I'd need longer arms or something to reach them comfortably. Plus, I can't find them.
Yeah, they were harder to
through the viewfinder.
Maybe I need more practice.
It could be that for me too, but they're a bit awkward.
So that's the only thing about the design that I didn't like.
Yeah. Let me mention a couple things that were not obvious to me in advance with this lens that I've since found to be kind of handy. And they were a little bit of a surprise. One of them has to do with the zoom feature. Mm-hmm. And, when we were on that trip to South Texas, we were photographing small birds. There were bushes and trees around them. And we frequently had the 1.4 teleconverters on. Mm-hmm. So we were photographing something in a very narrow angle of view. And one of the things I found was very handy about being able to zoom out with this lens had nothing to do with taking the photograph at a wider focal length. What it had to do was being able to find the bird.
Subject acquisition is the
yeah.
first name of the game.
So what I would do sometimes is zoom out, because then I had a wider
right.
field of view. I could figure out where the bird was and then zoom down to get just the bird, and it was a struggle trying to do it at the longest focal length.
Well, I had the same thing with trying to capture birds in flight.
Mm-hmm.
It's that you've got to pan with these, and that's hard. I mean, trying to follow a moving object when you've got such a narrow angle of view. So I found being able to zoom out gave me a lot better ability, because I was able to see that subject enter the frame and follow it much better
right.
than if I had been zoomed in all the way
right.
at a longer focal length.
Yeah, so if you're like me, you may be using the zoom feature in ways that don't have quite as much to do with the end photograph, but a
right.
very handy thing, and I use that a lot because otherwise I just couldn't find the bird sometimes. Second thing has to do with the instant manual focus override. Kind of a similar thing there too. What you can do is manually focus so you just get close to the right distance for your subject. This is where this is handy, is if you're switching subjects and the distance is changing appreciably. If you just try to point it in the general direction of your new subject and autofocus, it may just go all over the place because you're not actually pointing it at your subject. All you see in the viewfinder is this incredible blur.
Yeah.
Not a single thing is sharp. So what can be helpful is manually focus it to the approximate range of your subject. Then it'll be sharp enough so you can locate your subject and then allow the autofocus to pick it up.
Lock it in there.
And you don't have to flip switches around or anything like that. So that's another way I found the manual focus, the instant override, very, very handy. So kind of a hidden thing that was quite good. The one little nit I found with the manual focus override, I know there's an issue between you don't want to make it so easy to move into manual focus mode that by brushing the focusing ring inadvertently, you throw it into manual focus. But sometimes I found it was fighting me a little bit coming off of manual focus in an autofocus mode. So I had to almost overcompensate, swing the focus.
Because you're making
ring.
A micro adjustment.
Yeah.
I didn't detect that.
Yeah. I think I wish it picked it up, you know, picked up the override a little bit easier. But it was.
But, you know, these are small points. Now, I remember reading a review of this lens on, I think it was Moose Peterson's site. Mm-hmm. And he just drooled and he just said how much. And I said, Moose, there you go again. You know, you're just going off.
Yeah,
and
saying, but he's right.
But he's right. He is so right on this.
He's usually right, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, and I just hadn't used enough pro Nikon glass. I think that's the problem. So, I mean, as far as all of these things, if you make your money shooting little birds, then I would say, yes, there is no substitute for a 500 or 600.
Probably the 600.
Probably the 600 at that point, and all of that it entails. But if you are more of a generalist in terms of your subjects, if you're going to shoot the occasional, you know, moose and deer, and you know, and you want to be able to get close to your subject, you know, you're routinely being able to get under 15 feet, there isn't anything better that I can come up with for a long lens.
And in an ideal world, I'd have one of these and a 600 f/4. But one, I can't afford that. Right. No way. This was a stretch as it was.
Yep.
And then two, I don't think I can carry them either.
No.
So this is a great compromise.
This lens is packable.
Me.
Fits in the
I'm
bag.
I'm very happy with it. And I think I made a good decision.
Comes with a nice soft padded case too.
Yeah.
A very nice one. I haven't used it, but it is very nice what it comes
looks
with.
Looks good in my closet.
Yeah.
All right.
So definitely thumbs up for me.
Yep.
Okay. So... we got a suggestion in our podcast forum asking whether or not we could talk about the autofocus system in the D2X and the
D2HS,
the Multicam 2000 autofocus module. Now, before we go any farther, let's point out that this material is covered at length in the Nikonian's resource pages. Our very own Digital Daryl wrote an excellent article after many hours on the phone consulting with Nikon Technical. And I will say that I've talked to some of the people at Nikon Technical, and they have read the article, and they all agree that it's a well-written and good resource for using the autofocus system in this camera. Because there's been a lot of – this is a complicated thing, and there's a lot of different ways of using this autofocus. There's a lot of different modes.
It's a very powerful autofocus system,
and it's tricky to use. If
it is, it can be tricky. You know, I've had the camera for a while now, and I still have to kind of think through my shooting situation, what autofocus mode makes sense, and you have to put some thought behind it.
Absolutely, it's
if you want to get everything out of it that it can do.
It's the one thing that I'm probably still learning after a year with this camera. I'm still learning because I'm not always using every situation. So I'll sometimes come across a situation where I said, maybe I'll change this and see what happens.
Yeah, and I'll have to refresh myself periodically, you know, read through his article or the instruction book. I can, you know, if the camera's been sitting for a little while, like a few weeks or a month, or if I haven't done a lot of photography of active subjects recently, it's easy to forget what the heck
these
modes do.
That's just because you're older than I am.
Yeah, okay. You're really, really old. Okay, so anyway.
I mean, because it is a complex system and has a tremendous amount of customizable functions and modes, it's very powerful, but at the same time, it can be incredibly confusing.
Yeah.
So let's just go through it a little bit.
Yeah, by the way, if you do have a new D200, almost all of this will apply. It's got a very nice autofocus system. It's got the same basic settings that we'll talk about, same kind of modes. It's got a few other little twists on it. But I think you'll find most of this stuff usable. And I'm certainly a lot more familiar with how it works in the D2X than the D200 at this point. So maybe we'll do that discussion a little bit later.
And I don't have a D200, so I have to call my dad and see what how his works or ask you.
But they're pretty similar.
The layout, probably the thing that was the best leap forward from those of us like me who are using an F5 or an F100, is that the Multicam 2000 in the D2H and the D2X has 11 autofocus sensors instead of 5.
Mm-hmm. So it's a bunch.
So it's a bunch. It's plenty. 9 of these are the cross type or T type sensors. So they're more sensitive in lower contrast settings.
And they can pick up patterns that are both horizontal mm-hmm. as well as vertical.
Yeah, and there's an issue of, I think it's popular photography. It actually shows the arrangement of the actual sensors, not just the little marks.
Yeah, they're not the same.
They're not the same. The two outermost on the left and right, when you're looking through the viewfinder, the two outermost sensors are not cross-type, so they tend to be the least sensitive. They're vertical in orientation, and so that means if you're trying to focus on a vertical, like a pole, they might not work. But if you're focusing on something that's horizontal, they'll snap right in yeah. quite well.
And if you can find that popular photography article, I think you can get it on their website.
Yeah,
it's a PDF.
So
it's useful looking at, because what you'll find out is that the sensor size is appreciably bigger, really,
right.
than the settings that are marked on the focusing screen.
And that's good and bad.
It's good and bad. You know, think about these sensors as pretty much touching each other in reality.
Right.
So that you can have virtually continuous coverage across the zone that the sensors span. There aren't really a lot of gaps.
Right.
And that's great for things like the dynamic autofocus mode that we'll talk about later.
Right.
Subject moving around. Where it can cause you trouble is if you don't realize that the sensors are that large. You could be taking a picture of your Aunt Mary and have a tree in the background that has lots of contrast, maybe more than Mary's face. And if the sensor is spanning both subjects, guess what it may focus on?
Right.
The tree in the background, because it's got lots of contrast.
But so we'll talk about those kind of
things. You just have to be aware of it, and it works okay.
Yeah.
You know, not a problem, but if you're not aware of it, you may have some
trouble.
It can
lead to some potential frustration because you think your focusing point is on
yeah.
one spot and camera is not on another.
And
the camera's not doing anything wrong.
I did it inadvertently early on.
Oh, yeah. It's not hard to do.
No.
Another thing, let's see. With all of the autofocus Nikons, most of them at least, you're given the option of two ways of driving the autofocus motor itself. Single servo or AFS mode or continuous servo AFC mode. And the difference between these is, this is a decision. You have to set a switch on the front of the camera body itself. So this would be something you need to be thinking about at the outset before you start taking pictures. Am I shooting a fairly static subject from maybe a tripod, or am I shooting a moving subject? In single servo AF mode, the camera will attempt to lock the focus, and then it will not change that focus point once it has acquired focus. In continuous servo mode, the camera will never settle. It will always, it may stop moving the lens, but it'll continuously try to fix the focus.
Right.
It'll monitor the distance. That's right.
Yeah.
So you have to be thinking about that. Another setting you can do on the D2, even the F5, you could do this, is decide whether you wanted to use release priority shutter release or focus priority shutter release.
Now, what does that mean?
What does that mean?
Well, it means that in the case of release priority, whenever you press down the shutter release, it's going to shoot the picture, whether or not the camera thinks the subject is in focus.
That's right.
The idea there is that it's more important to get the shot at some peak moment mm-hmm. of activity than it is to have precise focus. And that's a valid thing.
There are
thing.
Situations
and,
where sure. that's important.
Sure.
For example, if you switch your camera to manual focus mode, it's always in release priority.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one of those things that happens.
Yeah. Now, in the other situation, the camera has to think that the subject is in focus before it will release the shutter. Now, in that situation, that's what's called focus priority. And in that situation, you're probably more likely, in general, to get a photo that's sharp. But there, if the camera, for some reason, isn't seeing something with enough contrast that it could lock on, you may start trying to press down the shutter release, and it just won't release.
Right.
And I've had that happen.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen a lot, But it can happen if your subject doesn't have enough contrast where the camera gets confused. They're both useful. You just have to know the circumstances under which to use them. Generally, I keep the camera set to focus priority for both single servo and continuous focus modes.
Right. And in the D2X, that is not how the default comes.
No.
The default is set so that when you're in, when you're shooting in single shot mode, it shoots by default to focus priority, which kind of makes sense. You're going to compose and shoot. But when you're set to continuous mode, it's set to just deliver the appropriate frame rate regardless of whether it's in focus. So it sets it to release priority.
Right.
So
you'd have D200 is the same.
And you would have to alter that custom setting.
Yeah.
And the specific settings are discussed in Daryl's article. And now we get to the part that confuses everybody. Should we talk about the custom function A4?
Why not?
The lock-on feature.
Right.
Okay. The Nikon cameras uses a predictive autofocus mechanism. It tries to predict where the subject will be if it's moving so that when you take the picture, it's actually in focus. There is a slight shutter lag. It's very small with the D2X. It's 37 milliseconds. But, you know, in the time, especially between frames, if you're shooting off at using continuous frame advance on a moving subject, the camera is going to try to track the subject and predict where it's going to be when the shutter is released, not necessarily when you push the button. You can modify this as well to decide how sensitive the camera is to a moving subject by using custom function A4, lock on,
right.
On
now,
or off.
There are two ways of viewing this, and you just mentioned the first one. The first one is you're varying the sensitivity at which it's going to alter the focus. You know, so if something changes in the perceived distance,
what does the camera
from the
do?
Camera to the subject, what does the camera do?
And a great
how quickly
example
does it
of
start
this
is switching?
Let's say I'm panning and I'm following a moving motorcycle, and the motorcycle goes behind a street pole. If I have custom setting function A4 turned on, or lock on is on, when that street light, that pole comes in front of between my subject and me, the camera will ignore it.
If it's a brief enough change.
If I sit it on the pole, it'll eventually acquire that.
Which means that what you're doing is you're making the autofocus mechanism a little bit less sensitive to abrupt changes in focusing distance.
Right. Now, on the other hand, if I turn that off and another subject comes between me and my potentially intended subject, the camera may try to reacquire on this other nice contrasty subject.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the majority of times, my gut feeling is to use the lock on turned on.
Yes, because the key word that I was using earlier is abrupt changes in focus. Gradual ones, not so much of a problem. It's really the abrupt change in distance that this parameter affects. So most of the time when you have that abrupt change in distance, it's because something like a branch comes in and gets in the way of the subject, or the light pole that you mentioned, or something like that.
Especially if you're following a moving subject.
But so most of the time, I think you can keep it on. Just realize that if you're in a set of circumstances where you're not going to have anything between you and your subject, and it may be a very rapidly moving subject in terms of, you know, the focusing distance changing, then you might turn it off.
Right. And then there's been some threads in the discussion, especially over in the D2X discussion area or in the wildlife discussion area about focus mode. And some people swear that by turning A4 to off, they get better performance. Well, it certainly will be faster. And I did find a situation in Texas where turning A4 off made all the difference in between acquiring focus and not. And that was when I was trying to follow a flying bird that was launching from a perch. So I had the target acquired when the bird was sitting on this perch. And these were the large caracaras. So this was not a small bird. But when I was shooting it, when it would take off, it would lose the autofocus system would lose the acquisition. And that's because the bird launched and it changed the subject distance very rapidly, and the camera was still focusing on the perch.
Right.
While we were sitting in the blind having a beer, I had a revelation that, maybe I'll try turning A4 off.
Beer helps in that respect.
Beer does help. Yeah. Sometimes you can alter your judgment for the better, and in this case it did. I turned that off, and the next thing I knew, I had some incredibly tack-sharp pictures of these flying birds where I was not only was the subject moving, but I was trying to pan the camera to keep up with it. But for the most part, I keep A4 turned to the on, on yep. setting. Now let's go through the modes.
Yeah, yeah. The simplest one, and it's the one that Nikon autofocus cameras originally had, is what's called a single area mode. And that's just using one sensor. You can move it around. You can select
which
sensor.
You can select one with the D-pad.
It is. But it's just one sensor and none of the others, and it doesn't do any fancy things like handing off the autofocus from sensor to sensor. It just whichever
you
one
lock
you want,
it into that sensor,
and that's it. So very simple to use. If your subject isn't moving, it's a nice way to go, and you can do things like press the shutter release halfway down. It'll lock focus.
Right.
You can recompose. Be a little bit careful with that.
What I find
sometimes
works really
you can get
nicely
out of focus images doing that.
Is using this with single servo mode.
Yeah,
with a portrait. I want to take a picture of my wife. I'm gonna lock the sensor on her eye, and now if I'm continuing to hold down the shutter release halfway, focus is locked. I can recompose now and release even if I'm in focus priority, because the camera, even if I've recomposed, the camera believes and knows that understands that in single servo mode, focus has been locked.
Right. Now here's the one gotcha, and it's what I was kind of hinting at before. The closer you get to your subject. Think about trigonometry and everything.
Right.
The more of a difference there is in the focusing distance between something that's straight ahead and something that's at an angle, you know, that's off center. So as you get closer to your subject in a portrait that's very close as an example of this, I would not use the recompose feature. I would switch the sensor and put it, you know, close to the subject's eyes.
Because you're saying that the focus will actually
the
shift.
Distance,
yeah, the distance
is
will change.
Different enough that
right.
it won't be sharp anymore, especially at wide aperture.
But that's why you use something like an 85 millimeter lens to take a portrait, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
okay.
That's, any rate, that's the single area mode. You can use it with, I use it mostly with single servo, but you could use it with continuous too if you know your subject is moving a little bit.
Now the next one is the dynamic lever. Area, and that's the one I was using most down in Texas.
Yes, me too.
Yeah. You know, and the idea there is you identify where your subject is starting at, you know, where in the frame it is, and you do that by moving the autofocus sensor around so it's selected. And then if that subject starts moving, the camera will be able to follow its motion through the frame and switch to another sensor. Hand off to another one. It works pretty well.
Right. And this
it's
is
quite
really,
amazing to watch it happen.
Really nice with, you know, here you're going to want to probably be in AFC mode. I can't understand why you would be in single servo at this point. Doesn't really make any sense. Unless you're just lazy like me and you forget to switch modes. But it's a little bit more control has been given to the camera. The camera's allowed to choose an AF point. After you have made the initial selection.
Right.
So you still control the starting point. And this is great when you have a relatively small subject that's moving around in the frame and there's not a lot of clutter in the frame.
Right.
It works pretty good is the way I found. And we move up on the switch to the next position, the one that looks like a diamond. This is a cool thing that this is something that
is new.
It's new to the D2 series with the multicam 2000. The previous two modes were very similar to what you'd find in the F5's
the F100
cam 1300 system. And that's called group dynamic autofocus.
Yeah, and with here you're selecting an area of the frame that you would like to have autofocus operating within. It's essentially grouping a set of sensors together, almost into mega sensor.
Yes, Uber sensor.
The Uber sensor, yeah. And Uber sensors are great if your subject is, you know, fairly good sized, maybe a large moose or something like that, or, you know, if you're doing sports, maybe a player that's making up a pretty good percentage.
Especially if
of
you're
the frame.
Fairly far away, where depth of, you know, where you're not going to have a lot of difference in distance between the bottom part of that sensor and the top part of that sensor. Yeah. What I found is sometimes if I use group dynamic, it will like to lock on to something else if I have a particularly busy frame rather than my subject. But it's really cool, especially for something like flying birds, and you know, where you're tracking a moving subject, or sports, shooting football. I don't care if that's football over the pond or on this side of the, you know, you know, shooting athletes. Group dynamic is excellent because you're telling the camera to keep the use a set of the sensors in the certain part of the frame, so the left side, the right side, the center, and you can change the pattern. Mm-hmm. The custom functions, and you can change it to whether or not you want it to use the center sensor to initially acquire the center sensor in the group, or if you wanted to do something even more fancy and use the closest subject priority. Mm-hmm. In other words, it will try to lock on using the whichever sensor in the group is detecting the closest subject.
Yeah. So the thing I like about group dynamic as opposed to regular dynamic is you can limit the area in which the autofocus is operating, and not have it use some of the sensors. So, but I do typically have to think kind of hard before selecting one of those.
But it's really good for when you're shooting, you know, something that's like I said, like a group of flying or a large animal or flying birds or something.
And the last one, which I can never remember the name of, is dynamic.
Dynamic autofocus with closest subject priority. This is the topmost position on the D2X. And this is what I like to refer to as total idiot mode.
Yeah. Whatever's closest in the frame of view, it focuses on.
And it uses all the sensors, and it just decides for you not only which sensor, but also, you know.
It's a little bit slower to acquire focus because it's having to think through so much. But that's what it does.
Right.
So if you have no obstructions and there's no issue about what part of the subject you want to focus on, that'll work pretty well.
Yeah, if there's no depth of field.
Yeah.
This is the hand the camera to a friend and say, take our picture at the bar settings. It works quite well.
Right. Now let's talk about some situations where autofocus may not work as well. And you just have to be aware of these things. Mm-hmm. Think about it. Sometimes you'll switch to manual focus mode.
And let's face it. I mean, these are machines. These are incredibly amazing in what they can do. Sometimes you have to remember that it's still not as good as your brain and your eye.
Right.
There are limitations.
So the first one is a subject that has low contrast.
Right.
And if the subject just doesn't have a very good pattern, you know, contrasting dark and light areas, it's not going to be able to lock on. If you want to see this happen, point your autofocus sensor at a white wall with no texture, and it'll just freak out. And so that's an extreme example, but you know, even situations where it could be, let's say, an animal or a bird that doesn't have much texture.
Oh, dogs are really great for this.
Dogs can be tough. yeah. And
unless it's a Dalmatian or something.
Right. So, you know, be aware of those kind of subjects that will cause a problem, and it might be better to switch to manual focus. Low light, if there's just not enough light on your subject and you're not using any, you know, the illuminator on the camera, I like to turn those off usually.
Well,
actually,
the D2X doesn't have an illuminator on
the camera. Yeah, but on ones that do, I find them distracting.
Yeah.
Yeah, the flash will do it sometimes.
Now, the D2X system, I will say, in low light is damn good.
Oh, it is.
It's amazing.
But it's not going to be
but
perfect.
But you couple that with, say, now a low contrast subject in poor light, and now you're asking yourself to have autofocus not acquire properly.
Right. Small target size.
Yeah, this is a big one that we see a lot. You know, a lot of people are having trouble with focus.
If your subject is a lot smaller than those big sensors that we talked about earlier, it may have trouble.
Yeah.
And one of the little tricks that you can try is to, you know, find two subjects that are at differing distances. Maybe one is at 10 feet and one is at 30 feet. And place a sensor, you know, with those big sensors, so it spans both subjects equally, and find ones that are of more or less equal contrast. You can make the autofocus system lock in halfway between the two.
Right, and that's just, it's doing its job.
There's no subject there,
right?
But it'll do it because that's the distance at which it gets the most contrast in general. I can make mine do that.
You know,
but it's kind of an artificial thing. But just one of those things you got to be aware of
right. When
your subject is very small.
And this feeds back
may
into
have a problem.
This feeds back into what we were saying about the size of the autofocus sensors as relates to the size of the markings in the viewfinder, because the sensor is larger. If your intended subject is quite small, like the same size as those little brackets look, the sensor is a lot bigger than that. It may might be very happy finding a higher contrast subject, like a tree branch or something that isn't where you bullseyed the target. But because that was the, you know, more desirable, more contrasty target, it found it, even though it doesn't look like it from where you're putting the autofocus sensor in the viewfinder.
And you know, a related thing is the subject isn't parallel to the sensor plane.
Oh yeah,
or film plane.
This is a biggie.
Yeah, we did a little bit of consulting with someone that was having trouble with their D2X, and one of the things that we looked at was a portrait shot of someone. And within the area that the sensor was covering, there were eyes, a cheek, and an ear. And what was happening is it was focusing behind the eyes. And that was because the sensor was big enough to pick up all those things. They were at differing distances, and it kind of averaged them out.
Yeah, it averages them out.
Well, you know, most people don't like sharp shots of cheeks. They want the eyes in focus. And so it just... Mm-hmm. And one of those things to be aware of.
Right.
So,
I mean, and I find this all the time with birds. I mean, or any kind of wildlife, you want the eye in focus, okay?
Yeah.
But that bird's wing has got a nice pattern on it, and it's a little bit closer to you than the head. So the head's going to, and with a big lens where you have low depth of field, you find the body is in focus and the head is not. And this is not your camera's fault.
Nope.
This is how it works. And
I have plenty of those shots, too.
And those are times where you might want to use manual focus and do a little touch-up.
Yep. Yep.
So while this is certainly not the comprehensive review of the D2X autofocusing system, we urge you, anyone who has a D2H or D2X, and even a D200, go and read Daryl's article in the Nikonians resource pages. You can get there by going to resources.nikonians.org. And under the Nikon product articles section, go and find the Cam 2000 article.
And then 2 weeks later, read it again.
Right.
And then 2 months later, read it again.
Only way to go.
Yep. Okay.
Well, that's all we have for today. So we thank you again for listening. We'll see you in another 2 weeks with some more exciting topics.
Yep. And then we're going to listen to Shannon's outro music here.
Yep. Thanks again, Shannon.
All right.
See you
bye-bye.
Next time. Bye-bye.